Chapter 2, Patent Law 101. This chapter is intended to provide you with an overview of the patent law field. The first section provides a very basic but fast-moving introduction to patent law. If you know a lot about patent law, you may choose to skip this part, although it may offer some benefits to readers who know about their particular line of work. The remainder of the chapter is organized by the possible choices you can make in determining where you'd like to begin your career and where you hope to go. As you read this chapter, allow the options available to you in the patent law field to interact with the big picture issues raised in the previous chapter. The values you considered or articulated in Chapter 1 will help you guide your specific decisions. While the extent to which your values are realized in your job depend on the specifics of any individual workplace, you can increase the likelihood of finding a good match based on how you position yourself within the field. Patent law is a subset of intellectual property, IP law, which includes patent law, which protects inventions and areas such as copyright, works of art, trademark, logos, slogans, etc., and licensing, granting others the rights to use protected intellectual property. Patents protect inventions on the basis of their design and/or their use, plus biological inventions such as plant strains, by giving the inventor exclusive rights to the patented invention for a specific period of time, usually 20 years from the date the patent is filed. To get patent protection, the inventor must show that the invention is both new and non-obvious. Basically, it must be something that someone else has not invented and something that is not a logical evolution or tweak of an existing invention. Recently, much of the demand for patent law professionals has come from the computer, biotech, and pharmaceutical industries, although there are definitely other fields in high demand. Intellectual property law is a particularly hot area right now. Even though the media's coverage of things like illegal music downloading makes it seem like IP professionals are in demand across the board, patent attorneys and patent agents represent a very large proportion of the IP field. In fact, the vast majority of IP law's hotness comes from the patent law part of the field. Moreover, patent law professionals are a very select group. To practice law, all attorneys must complete their law degree and pass the state bar exam. Patent attorneys and patent agents must also pass the patent bar exam, run by the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office. Patent agents who do not have a law degree but can prosecute patents before the USPTO must also pass the patent bar exam. In order to take the patent bar exam, both agents and attorneys must demonstrate a high level of technical knowledge, ordinarily at least a Bachelor of Science degree or a Bachelor of Science in Engineering. However, many patent attorneys and agents have more advanced technical degrees. Less than half of exam takers pass the exam, narrowing the field still farther. Patent attorneys have still more good news. First, there are generally more jobs advertised in patent law than in many other legal fields, as well as the fewer candidates qualified to fill those jobs. Second, if a law firm decides to hire just one IP professional, they will often choose a patent attorney. This is not only because there is so much work in patent law, but also because patent attorneys are typically capable of working on other forms of intellectual property. The reverse is not true, because specialists in other fields lack the technical knowledge that is so important to a patent attorney. This is less true of litigators than of prosecutors. See below for more on that distinction. Do I want to be a patent agent or a patent attorney? For some, that question is already answered. You've been to law school and jumped through all the hoops necessary to be a patent attorney, or you haven't been to law school and you don't intend to go. For some of you, though, that's still an open question. The most likely form it takes is that you are embarking on a career as a patent agent, and you're not sure whether or when to go back for that JD. Not surprisingly, obtaining a law degree will afford you more status and privilege, as well as more compensation. Across the whole demographic, there are patent agents who are very good at what they do, have especially strong backgrounds, and have made excellent career choices. Those individuals can achieve some of the same advantages of being a patent attorney, and they can make more money and have more status than some patent attorneys. As an individual, no matter what your position, you will have more money, status, and opportunity if you have the law degree. It's not a matter of whether, but of how much, and how those advantages weigh against the cost of a law degree, financial or otherwise. For example, if you spent your 20s and early 30s getting a PhD and winning postdoctoral research fellowships in computer science, you may have a very specialized background that will be valuable to employers and provide you with interesting and well-paid work. At the same time, you might think that it's high time to start a family, and you don't want to spend your hours outside of work reading legal textbooks. If you think you might want to go on to law school, it's useful to consider your preferences for accomplishing that goal. For example, how far in the future do you expect to start school? 2 years? 10 years? Maybe someday? Will you leave your job to be a full-time student, or will you work and attend school at the same time? How does this trajectory affect your current situation? If you're considering keeping your job while in school, it's worthwhile to consider ways in which a particular employer could be supportive of that project. In some jobs, it's simply impossible to find the time, while other employers might work with you as you juggle those responsibilities or help you with tuition. In general, the stronger and more in demand your background, the more likely employers are to support you attending law school. It's even possible that they'll pay your way through law school, lessen your work requirements so you have more time for school, and then they'll pay you more when it's all over. When they see it as an investment in a valuable employee, not a bad deal. What is or will be my specialty, and how important is it to me? Because of the highly technical nature of patents, virtually all patent attorneys and patent agents specialize to some degree. The extent to which you specialize will depend upon a number of factors, including whether you work on the litigation or patent prosecution side. Prosecutors are usually more specialized than litigators. It will also depend on the size and specialty of the firm you work for, whether you work for a law firm at all, or a government agency, or a university, and your preferred career trajectory. For example, in a smaller firm, you're more likely to have a specialty like biotechnology. In a larger or boutique firm, you might deal exclusively with patent applications claiming genes. Over time, it's possible to narrow your specialty. You could go from a small firm to a larger one to a boutique firm. Or you could widen it by starting out at a larger firm and then opening your own consulting business where you provide a variety of services on a wide range of technologies. You may also find yourself in a situation where you're the most qualified person, even outside your specialty, so you're working on patents outside of your area of expertise. And as the introduction above observed, it's also possible to branch out to the point where you're doing patent prosecution and other IP work. In fact, some employers will give attorneys other IP work to keep them happy in their jobs by relieving the potential boredom of doing patents all the time. Many, perhaps most people, drawn to the patent law field have a specialty already, from majoring in biochemical engineering as an undergraduate, by getting your PhD and having postdocs in computer science, or by working as an aeronautical engineer for 7 years. Obviously, starting from what you already know is a good way to begin to consider your field of specialty. Many people enter the patent law field with the intention of taking advantage of their existing knowledge and building their whole career around it. It's also possible, though, to narrow, broaden, or change specialties. Or you can even leverage your field of specialty as a way of moving out of that more technological work. For example, if you're an aeronautical engineer who wants a change of pace that stresses your persuasive communication skills, you could become a patent litigator. Your technological background will serve you well, but you can also develop the interpersonal angle so that the legal work takes center stage. If you're interested in shifting your specialty in any of these ways, it's useful to consider certain questions, and the more radical the shift, the more important those questions will be. You need to know how you're going to get from here to there in a way that still takes advantage of your existing knowledge and experience. Do you want to start off in your current field and then gradually reorient yourself? Do you want to do a greater variety of work? Will you want to go back to school to get a different degree? Specialization can be the major factor shaping your job search, insofar as the specialization you bring to your search and how you want your specialty to develop or shift over time. If your field, or, on the other hand, changing your field is very important to you, you need to focus on how your particular field intersects with the patent law field. The following questions will assist you in that determination. Are there particular firms or types of firms that employ people with your specialty? If so, what are they? Are there geographical locations where firms related to your specialty tend to cluster? If so, where? Are there many or few infringement cases related to your specialty, affecting the litigator versus prosecutor decision? Is your specialty one with a high demand for patents but few specialists, or vice versa? Or is it one where, to really get ahead, you need to have a PhD in a field, but you only have a BS? Is it one that lends itself to university or government work, as opposed to law firm work? These are the things you should consider and research as you prepare to launch your job search, or earlier if possible. Prosecutor or litigator? In addition to field of specialization, the technical knowledge you bring to the content or topic of the patent at issue, you also need to consider the form of the work you'll do. Almost all patent attorneys will either be prosecutors, people who draft patent applications and negotiate with the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office, or litigators, people who try cases. Usually, there is very little crossover between the two categories. If you are a patent agent, you have a similar decision to make, although the situation is somewhat more complicated. It's addressed at the end of this section because it's useful to understand the distinction from the attorney perspective first in order to grasp how it's different for patent agents. In general, people who enjoy and are good at working in any aspect of patent law are detail-oriented, thorough, organized, analytical, and logical, and have good research skills. Beyond that, there are differences in skill set, knowledge, and personality type between prosecutors and litigators. To be a good prosecutor, you need the following. Number 1. Good communication or people skills. While the prosecutor versus litigator distinction might appear to revolve around writing, drafting applications, versus speaking, arguing cases, that's not entirely the case. In the process of drafting the application, you work closely with your client, the inventor. The inventor could be an individual or small group, but it's often a large company, in which case you will deal with a representative from that business. Getting every detail of the patent can require some prying, or at least well-developed interview skills. Later, once the case is before the patent examiner, you'll often play the role of advocate, mediator, arguing the client's position to the examiner. You'll also assist the client in understanding the patent office's position, and work with both to find a suitable middle ground. Number 2. Technical knowledge. Patent applications can be extremely technical, and you need to be able to communicate with everyone involved using the technical knowledge and vocabulary specific to that field of patents. You need to fully understand the scope of the inventions, as well as their various applications and utilities. You also need to be able to compare proposed inventions with prior art disclosures, and identify those features of inventions that are novel and not obvious variations. In order to do so, you need to be familiar with the material or have the knowledge and technical fluency to be able to familiarize yourself with it quickly. Number 3. Technical writing skills. It's one thing to be able to take in extremely technical information. It's another thing entirely to be able to write about it with clarity. Technical means technological and specialized, but it also means procedural and precise. You have to be able to nail down exactly what you're talking about, what your client wants you to be talking about. It should be noted that patent applications are fairly long, anywhere from 30 to 60 pages to much more. In fact, it's probably not enough to be good at technical writing. You should also like doing it, because you'll be doing it a lot. Number 4. Creativity. Patent law prosecutors need to be precise, but they also need to be able to think outside the box, to brainstorm or speculate, to ensure that any and all possibilities for the patent are at least suggested in the original disclosure. In other words, you need to be able to anticipate all possible applications, uses, or combinations with the object of the patent that could be valuable. You need to be able to close loopholes about something that doesn't exist yet, so you need to be able to imagine what they could be. Patent litigators do different kinds of work. What you might think is the primary difference, or oratorical flourish in a public setting, isn't as central to being a patent litigator as you might think. When we think of litigators, we usually picture dramatic courtroom scenes out of Law and Order. In reality, most patent litigators rarely see the inside of a courtroom. There are two reasons why. First, almost all patent cases are settled, disbanded, or dismissed before getting to a judge and jury setting. Second, while there might be 7 to 10 people on a given litigation team, only one or two will actually be speaking in court. In fact, within the field of litigation, there are often additional divisions of litigators into those who actually conduct trials and those who don't. If you are going into this field because you want to make dramatic courtroom speeches and plan your career accordingly, you can probably find opportunities to do so. The real reason for making this point stems from the fact that more people are afraid of public speaking than anything else, even death. If you are one of those people, don't immediately dismiss the idea of being a litigator. You need to be smooth to sell your case to others, but you don't need to be anywhere close to Sam Waterston playing Jack McCoy, or whoever looms in your head when you picture a litigator. In reality, you'll be spending most of your time in the office reviewing evidentiary documents, analyzing patent history, reading case law, and so forth. That said, being a litigator requires the following. Number 1. Good persuasive skills. You need the same communication or people skills a prosecutor needs. The difference is that the prosecutor's communication is more oriented towards communicating with the client and making sure that the patent case is clearly laid out. Arguing the case before PTO officials is a secondary skill because the patent application should speak for itself. When you're a litigator, you're dealing with a case of infringement. It's an inherently more adversarial context. You're almost always trying to convince someone of something, whether it's your client, the judge, your opponent, or even colleagues in your firm. For example, if you're debating whether to settle the case or go to trial. Number 2. Legal knowledge. Prosecutors are primarily, even exclusively, focused on the patent application and the invention itself. However, litigators spend a majority of their time locating applicable case law, assessing rules of evidence, interpreting statutes and regulations, and other legal work more narrowly defined. For this reason, legal knowledge is at least as important as technical knowledge for a litigator. Number 3. Technical fluency, as opposed to technical knowledge. Litigators tend to work in less specialized subfields than prosecutors, so previous knowledge of the science behind a particular case of infringement is not always feasible, though it always helps. What is essential is to be able to get up to speed on the technical jargon related to a particular case, and to be comfortable communicating about it. For that reason, it's helpful to have a scientific or technical background because it gives you knowledge of the field you're familiar with, and a general competence about how technical knowledge works. It's analogous to languages. If you can speak both Spanish and English, that doesn't mean that you can speak French, but you're probably better prepared to learn French than someone who only speaks English. That said, for extremely technical cases, and even some less technical ones, litigators can often turn to technical specialists or opinion people for backup. Number 4. Analytical skills. Whereas prosecutors need to think outside the box, litigators are dealing with a closed system. All the facts are in, and it's a matter of either, number 1, finding some way of avoiding infringement, if you're representing the defendant, or, number 2, proving that the defendant is infringing your valid patent claims, if you're representing the plaintiff. If you're a litigator, your job is to find the path through all of the evidence, previous cases, existing regulations, and other relevant data that will most strongly support your case. That's a very different mental process. There is a third category that lies in between prosecutors and litigators. People who specialize in opinion work, as in legal opinions. They review and evaluate technology and/or issued patents to opine a patent's patentability, commercial value, potential for being infringed, and so forth. Opinion people are often brought onto a litigation team, especially when the invention involved is especially high-tech or complex and really requires review by a specialist. People who do this type of work are most often those with PhDs in their field, and might have additional research, academic, or other experience. Unless you fit into that category already, it's unlikely that you will be long in this category, particularly if you're just beginning your career. Let's return to how this picture looks for patent agents. Patent agents can assist with litigation teams, although they can't prepare patent opinions, sign briefs and motions, depose witnesses, or do other tasks that require a law degree. In practice, they are less likely to have direct contact with clients and more likely to research and draft documents that will be signed off by attorneys. This means, on litigation teams, patent agents can be second-class citizens, especially at larger and more impersonal firms. If you have a very strong technical background, plus a PhD, and/or experience working for the USPTO, in short, some credentialing that places you on your par with or above your attorney colleagues, you'll be considered more of a technical advisor as opposed to a patent agent. If so, you may be able to overcome this prejudice, though you might still experience pressure to get that JD. While there's nothing wrong with performing these responsibilities, if you are a patent agent and highly value status, you may want to consider focusing on prosecuting patent applications, where the work you'll do is much more similar to the work a patent attorney does. What kind of organization do I want to work for? Not all patent agents or attorneys work for law firms. Any organization where potentially patentable research and development is conducted, generally universities, government agencies like the National Institutes of Health, and corporations, may staff an in-house patent department. This might include attorneys and/or agents who prepare the patent applications, or it might include people who act as liaisons between the organization and law firms. The industry positions are usually considered in-house, while the university or government positions are part of a technology transfer department. If you take an in-house or tech transfer position, you may spend time drafting and prosecuting patent applications or overseeing patent portfolios, with the prosecution being handled by outside counsel. You will probably spend a significant portion of your time evaluating what the R&D folks determine is potentially patentable and commercially valuable, working on licensing matters, getting licenses for your people to use other patents and/or licensing others to use your organization's patents, and dealing with patent dispute and litigation matters, for example, seeking opinion of counsel as to whether the organization can do a particular thing without getting sued. Many other patent professionals are self-employed or work in small patent consulting firms as opposed to law firms. They might provide patent search and patent writing services for inventors, whether individuals or businesses, work on research agreements between different entities, for example, the government and a university or corporation, or counsel small businesses on when and how to pursue patents or other kinds of intellectual property rights. The paragraphs below focus on law firms for several reasons. For one, most patent attorneys and agents work for law firms, especially at the entry level. In addition, differences among in-house and tech transfer departments make it difficult to generalize about the work beyond the description above. While there are distinctions among firms, for the purposes of job hunting, there are two main viewpoints about what differentiates one firm from another. Number one, degree of specialization. And number two, size. As we'll see, size can sometimes be a descriptor that refers more to the type of firm rather than the literal number of attorneys. The degree of specialization is usually expressed in terms of general versus boutique firms. Boutique firms have one or more specializations. They focus on providing services for clients within a niche market. That market is often a particular industry or government agency. For example, telecom boutiques focus on the telecommunications industry and might work with the FCC. Boutiques can exist in any legal field, but the intellectual property field in general, and patent law in particular, are good candidates for boutique firms because the issues are so technical and complex. As a patent law specialist, you're more likely to find yourself in a boutique firm than those who are in other legal fields. In fact, it's useful to consider boutique firms as offering a fairly wide range of options, from IP, which, though broader than patent law in particular, is still considered a boutique field, to firms working exclusively on patents or a specialty within patent law, for example, medical patents, or, even more narrowly, on a subspecialty, for example, pharmaceutical patents. Boutique firms are frequently founded by lawyers who have worked at big firms and are well-connected in their field. In the legal field, it is less likely that an entry-level employee will be hired at a boutique firm. For our purposes, this generalization is complicated because patent law has more boutique firms than other fields, and many people entering the field of patent law have credentials that effectively promote them out of entry-level status. If you are interested in working for a boutique firm, don't assume that firms aren't interested in someone like you. But do your homework on individual firms so that you have a good idea of what each firm does and how you might fit into its identity. The large versus small distinction typically refers to the number of staff and attorneys at a firm, although it often describes the overall feel of a firm as shaped by the qualities described in the bulleted list below. Like the degree of specialization, size is a continuum. It is relative to the geographical location. For example, in a large city like New York or Los Angeles, a firm needs to be a lot bigger to be considered large than it does in Roanoke, Virginia, or Omaha, Nebraska. For that reason, and others, there isn't a systematic way of classifying firms. One person's small firm houses less than 20 attorneys, another's less than 50. In New York, it might be less than 200 or 300. The size issue is also complicated by the fact that some firms have more than one branch. While that firm as a whole may be large, each branch might work more like a medium-sized firm. Another matter related to size can be characterized as scale or scope: local, regional, national, or international. Local, national, and international categories are probably self-evident. A regional firm is best illustrated with some hypothetical examples. An Atlanta-based firm with one office might be one of the top three firms in Atlanta and have good name recognition throughout the South, but not beyond. It could also be a firm with several offices, all in the Midwest, or a Silicon Valley-based firm that grew up on tech-based projects and opened offices in other cities with a strong IT presence. Large firms tend to be suited to offer more services for one-stop shopping. At a large firm providing the full range of legal services, it's more likely you will have colleagues working outside of the fields of patent and IP law. This is especially true in business rather than personal law. Corporate law, international trade, banking, etc., as opposed to family or personal injury law. Given the size of the intellectual property field, it's also possible to work at a relatively large IP-focused boutique firm, where you might have colleagues working in IP-related fields like antitrust, FDA, and licensing. In either case, you will most certainly have colleagues working in patent law. Working at a large firm offers several generalizations that working at a smaller firm doesn't, and vice versa. These generalizations can be misleading for patent law professionals because the small versus large distinction is more complicated by the presence of larger boutique firms than in other fields. In general, the smaller the firm, the less pay, as well as the less expectation that you will rack up enormous quantities of billable hours. However, if you are working in a specialized and high-status boutique firm, that may not be the case. In general, people in smaller law firms tend to be more multifaceted and wear more hats than people in larger firms, who tend to be more focused. However, if you're working in a small boutique firm that focuses only on, say, patents related to genes, the range of hats you will wear will still be quite narrow. Also, in a larger firm, while you're more focused within any one position, there is often more opportunity to move around within the firm. Thus, in the immediate sense, employees are more focused at larger firms, but over time, they may not be. Larger firms tend to have more status than smaller firms. On the plus side, the experience at a larger firm looks good on your resume. On the negative side, it's harder to make partner and your job is less secure. Again, if you work at a very well-known, prestigious boutique firm, you may enjoy the status, though possibly in smaller circles, and you may also suffer from the lack of security. Larger firms tend to have more bureaucracy. While at first glance that may seem like a bad thing, it's not only a bad thing. Bureaucracy is, after all, a black sheep cousin of system, and systems definitely have their advantages. You may feel like you're only suffering from bureaucracy, but you'll also benefit from it in the form of predictability. You'll know what to expect and will be reasonably assured that it will happen. You can also benefit from increased administrative support systems. Small firms tend to be more collegial, and small boutique firms may even be more so because of the shared interests among the people working there. At large firms, you might not recognize all of your colleagues, and you're more expendable. On the other hand, the smaller the firm, the tone is more often set by one or a handful of people at the top. Occasionally, at boutique firms, which are often run by the firm's founders, there can be a cult of personality dynamic at work. If the people at the top create a good working atmosphere, that's great. If they don't, it's easy for one or two dysfunctional people to render the entire workplace toxic and make your life miserable. At a larger firm, you may be more protected from this dynamic by the deeper hierarchy. Your immediate supervisor protects you from the crazy partner, or vice versa, by the ability to transfer within the firm, and simply by the presence of more people to act as a buffer, or hide among. For entry-level employees in particular, large and small firms offer different experiences. If you work at a large firm, you'll likely be expected to focus on one specialty as your career progresses. But for a newbie, big firms can afford more opportunities to try new things. You might work for Partner A, who does litigation, and rotate over to Partner B, who prosecutes patents, or with Partner X, who works with big-name industrial clients, and then rotate over to Partner Y, who specializes in government work. The advantages of working in a smaller firm is that you'll likely be given more authority and autonomy sooner. That's because larger firms are more likely to have a deep hierarchical structure and systematic ways of supervising and mentoring, on the pro side, and monitoring, on the con side, inexperienced people. Also, fewer people means less people to watch over your shoulder and express their input or, more drastically, redo everything you do. At this point, you are developing a better sense of how choices in the field of patent law map onto your personal values and goals as articulated in Chapter 1. You'll probably have an idea of what you'd ideally like to do, or at least some avenues you'd like to explore more thoroughly, and possibly some you're pretty sure you don't want to check out. Of course, finding the perfect match for that ideal job depends on things like the size of the market you're working with. Do some investigating to find out what's out there. But before you get yourself in too deeply, you need to get your ducks in a row so you're ready when you find that job, or it finds you. That is the subject of the next chapter.